Just before we get started, the Second Act Podcast would like to acknowledge that we are recording this podcast on Treaty 7 land inhabited by the Blackfoot Nations. This includes the Siksika, Piikani, and Kainai. We would also like to acknowledge the Tsuut'ina and Stoney Nakoda First Nations, as well as the Métis Nations and all people who make their home on Treaty 7 land in southern Alberta. But now that we've paid respects to people that were here before us, let's start the pod. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Second Act Podcast. And today's episode is a really uplifting one.
Cassie Howerish has a great story about doing a bunch of different things. And she's had a few, obstacles in her life or things that made, the things that she was doing more difficult. And she persevered through it all the way through a collegiate, athletic career to being an alternate in the 2014 Olympics.
Yeah, this, like you mentioned, this story is a lot about perseverance and her belief that she can do these things. She started off playing volleyball and went to skeleton in the Olympics as an alternate, which to even be considered in the Olympics is pretty cool. But for something as like niche as skeleton, you have to be really good at that.
Yeah. And it was fun to sit down with Cassie and go through, all the trials and tribulations, how you end up in something that is kind of a little bit out of left field as it is. And in what goes into it when, you put all that time and effort in and maybe some things outside of your control your fate more than the actual performance on the track. So really fun, interesting conversation. Cassie was super generous with her time and we sat down and went and got all this sorted out and we couldn't be happier to have her. So ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, Cassie Howerish.
Hello. Hello, Gord, and all the listeners.
Thanks for joining us, Cassie. As I got looking into you after you were recommended to me by a friend of the show, Dave Strang, I started thinking to myself, this is exactly the type of person that I want to sit down and chat with. There's just so much varied, different kind of things, and they all go on their own, but they all kind of come back to the same. And I think it's a really interesting discussion on some of the decisions that you made that led you to this point.
Yeah, I'd say second act, maybe third, fourth, and fifth acts for me. So we'll have lots to cover for sure.
Well, and that's the beauty of it. And that's kind of why I got into this, was to chat with people who, chased the things that they love to do and figured out if something wasn't filling their cup, maybe there was something that wasn't, 180 degrees away that they could try. And your story really has that, because a lot of it is just kind of one thing bleeding into the next.
You're totally right. And I think more than anything, it was things that bled into each other, but that I didn't know were there. That's where it really gets interesting, because it wasn't as if I had it on my next to-do list. Each time something turned a corner, it presented itself, but I also had to be paying attention.
Yeah. And I think that's the fun part for people that listen to this and some of the more faithful listeners that want to hear the stories. They like to understand that, maybe not everything is preordained and something can be just around the corner. So what was, young Cassie growing up in Brandon, Manitoba, right?
That's right.
What was that kind of life like? Were you always an athletic, spunky little girl that was trying out all the different things, or how did you come to Windsor, right? As playing yes. volleyball. Was that your first kind of foray out?
Mm-hmm. That would be like the first big athletic exit from Manitoba. But yeah, so as a little girl, I was into everything in terms of sports, but I was also really dynamic in music and in theater and kind of whatever I could get my parents to drive me to be honest. Yeah. They were great about that. And we always had a bit of a deal where they, would encourage me to try it for some period of time. There was never any real, like, you have to do it for this many, but we'd get through like a season or a camp. And ultimately the question would be asked, did you enjoy it? Did you like, was it actually fun? Did you like the people you were with? And in some cases it would be absolutely yes. And in other cases it would be absolutely not. So in the cases where I didn't enjoy things, they weren't forcing me in any direction. And I say that because I have two pretty athletic parents. My dad's family for sure was very, very hockey related and lots of hockey history there. I learned how to skate from a really young age, but dad wasn't so much, thinking that I had to be a hockey player. And sometimes we joke that he should have pushed it a little bit, because in terms of, years of birth, it would have been the perfect way for me to get paid school if I had been a female hockey player. But, you know, I leave it to eventually finding winter sports as at a later date. But yeah, I was really looking for something to connect. And it was always about what I recently referred to, and I'll use it myself, as the hang. So like, who did I get to spend time with? And that was always the biggest deal, whether I was in a team sport or something more creative. And that's really, really still the case now in my late 30s. That's been so important. So who I got to surround myself in all of those cases actually was more important than what I was doing. But to the point, volleyball was the first sport that I found where I loved the actual activity of practicing, and I loved the competition, because there were some other instances where that wasn't the case, like basketball being the one thing that I thought of. I didn't like practicing. I liked playing, but practices were awful for me. I just thought they were so terrible. And at that point, there was kind of the option to do one or the other. I was French immersion student, so our school was very much, it was very small. So we didn't have a ton of sports available to us in terms of capacity for, you know, teachers and volunteers. So really it was kind of a choice for me in about grade 7 to really latch onto that sport. And that's the sport that I played pretty much exclusively from grade 7 through to my second year of university.
So it makes perfect sense, I guess, that somebody who was, you know, attracted to the social aspect of all of those activities ended up finding the greatest success in a solo sport like skeleton, but we can get to that as it comes. So French immersion student from Brandon, Manitoba, and you end up out in Ontario. On were you on a volleyball scholarship, or were you just playing on the university team there?
Yeah, so I'll give a little bit of background. So I would graduate grade 12 in the 2002 range. So just before that, really, we still, like, social media was still kind of coming soon. So, and I say that because of the way that we had to push out to try and find to actually find a way to go to school. So I'm an only child. I was looking for a scholarship and another way to really connect to my schooling. School was always going to be really important. And I did want to go to a university that had a program that I would graduate with a skill set that I wanted, not just a degree or a piece of paper. So we actually had a company at the time make, you know, and create and send out hundreds of VHS tapes at the time. And they all got sent out with just clips of me playing, and they'd had like a one sheeter created. And I don't know how much my parents spent on this, but I'm sure at the time it was quite a bit. And they went out across Canada and across North America. And I got lots of responses, and we got to do lots of visits, but they were all in the States. I didn't get a single response from a Canadian university. And I think that has a lot to do with, this is speculation, but I'm only 5'7". So they weren't looking, you know, if you looked at the rosters around that time, and even now, like, the girls are all well over 5'7". And I wasn't a setter, never been a setter. And libero had really only just come on to play for volleyball. I was an outside left hand, like left hitter. So power. And that's what I wanted to play. To your point, I had lots of offers for scholarships in the States. The dollar was still quite much like it is now. It really didn't have much comparison. And either I'd get lots of money and be able to go down and it would be great, and they'd have no program for me, or they'd have a great program and they couldn't offer me a full scholarship. And that was kind of where I was sitting right before I needed to make a decision. So I quite honestly researched all of the rosters across Canada and found that the only one that had a decent median height average was Windsor, Ontario. So I called them up and said, I'm going to come there. They have a communications program. I guess I'd like to try out. And the coach, Marilyn Douglas, who only just recently is not coaching anymore, she coached there for a very long time, had seen my video and said, yeah, okay, well, you can come out and try out with, you know, any of the other walk-ons if you'd like. And I said, okay. And that's how I started. That's how I went. Didn't get a scholarship, but did get on the team.
So there's like a whole podcast into that, to that point. I mean, that's incredible, especially when you, you know, you're talking about the effort that went into the VHS and the one sheeter and getting it out there and following it through. Mm-hmm. And then finding out that, gosh, nobody in Canada is that interested, but there is opportunities in the States, yep. But it's not exactly what you're looking for. How critical was the ability to get into, like something that's more journalism, communications-y? Was that a big piece of the puzzle?
Yeah, it was it was the biggest piece of the puzzle. So for some reason around grade 10, grade 11, I was presented with the opinion of someone else saying it to me as a teacher, saying that I was a very good writer. And that was just really impactful for me at the time. And there was some incredible efforts made. You know, there was some English teachers that would stay after volleyball practices and at school just to help me like go through writing assignments and just really encouraging a skill set that I didn't think was that big of a deal. But then when I started watching my dad find that the digitization of his world, and so he's a commercial sign painter, was really affecting his craft and his love for his business. I remember sitting at the dinner table somewhere around grade 11, listening to him like be upset about computers coming in and taking over something that he'd been doing for at that point, like 40 years. And I kind of marked my words at that time. I said it out loud. I was like, well, I want to do something that can never be replaced with computers. Right. And writing and connecting with people and being a journalist in some way, shape or form. And I've done it in all ways, I can tell you, was that thing. So that was really like, that was the only way I was going to school, was if it was going to be for an actual career that I felt I could do as a human being for the rest of time.
So the time in Windsor was actually fairly short lived though.
Mm-hmm.
Very. So what led into the decision to move out to, the U of R and kind of changed lanes there?
Yeah, it was a little bit of decision and a little bit of like pain, to be honest. My dad actually had a heart attack the first Christmas I was away at university. And he, while he lived and recovered and is still alive today, it was a huge blow for me to just recognize just how far I was away. I wasn't able to go back in short order to go like make sure he was all right. I was pretty much in no uncertain terms told that I had to wait until Christmas, and that was going to be a really long month and a half for me, and I wasn't pleased with that. So when I came back the following year after the summer of spending, I went back to Manitoba and was coming back to play again, there was just a lot of kind of like push and pull between the coaching staff and I really don't think I was where I needed to be. They kind of felt it, and there was just very much like a, well, if you don't want to be here, you know, we're not really sure if we want you. So, you know, make a decision. So I just redshirted that first semester, and in doing so, put out the call to try and go to a different university. And the School of Journalism at the University of Regina really stood out. I don't think I even knew it was there. And that for me, I was like, oh, wow, they actually have like the specific, because I was in communications and visual arts at the U of W. And that was a little bit different. It would have been more PR based in the end. I did a shout out to the university volleyball team, the Cougars at the U of R, and they were like, well, you can, same thing, like you'd have to sit out the rest of the year, but you can come out and try if you'd like. And I was like, all right, well, I'll figure it out and see what it's going to take to get into the School of Journalism too.
And so again, there's a whole nother arm and leg there about of that story. Yeah. Like your dad, I mean, obviously everyone's happy that it worked out, but I mean,
absolutely,
you're young at that point, very young, first time away. Yeah. And as you said, you're an only child, so you guys are a tight-knit little group of warriors there. And when,
like, for mom to call that, to make that phone call and tell me that day, that really like just changed everything. Yeah. And I don't think I realized at the time like what it was all about, but to go back to, you know, my desire to connect with people and to be around people that really support me and I support them, like their mom and dad are the pinnacle of that for me. So yeah, to be that far away in a time and recognize that you could lose that person, that they could not be there anymore. And I was only like 18, 19. Yeah, it was all or nothing for me. I was like, okay, I got to go closer to home. Like, I don't want to necessarily be in Manitoba. I think I would have picked it if I could have, but the U of R had a school, the J school, and that really did it for me. So,
well, and you were able to find some successes athletically outside of volleyball at your mm-hmm. time at the U of R. Like it really kind of gave you an opportunity to blossom, right?
Yeah, there was another big like heartbreak moment. It also happened, and my dad just, we just laugh about this, it happened on Father's Day of the following year. Just a lot of little things that seem to connect themselves. My mom and dad drove me down to the U of R, and that whole summer before I'd played like on spring league with the same team at the Cougars, really. It was the spring league Cougars. And I was waiting to see if I'd get into the School of Journalism, all happening in the same, like within a year and a half of me changing schools. They only take 26 people a year into the journalism program. So it was really, I had to go basically do my first year all over again in a different school, because a lot of my credits didn't transfer. It was chaos, but I just kept being like, it's going to work out. I'm going to get on the volleyball team. I'm going to make it work. And ultimately, tryouts, they seemed great. But the conversation in the coach's room after with all this coaching staff was, we were going to keep you, but we changed our mind. And that broke my heart into a million pieces. I thought for sure, and you know, full transparency, I had moved there and had a partner, like had a boyfriend there, and we'd just broken up. So I was like, what have I done? I've moved back across the country. I don't know anybody here really well. I haven't gotten to my program, and I just got cut from the team. Like, I think I might have effed up. Like, I don't, maybe this isn't it. And I was a mess for at least 2 weeks. And nobody, my mom, my dad, nobody, none of my family, nobody pushed me in any direction. We were still waiting to hear if I got into school. So there wasn't really a decision to be made. But something inside me, I couldn't imagine going to school without being an athlete. That's the truth. I'm like, what am I going to do the rest of the time? Even if I don't get into the program, I'm going to figure out some kind of degree. Like, I'm going to finish school. That was a big one for me. But what am I going to do the rest of the time? Like, all I do when I'm not studying or whatever, it's like, to train. So I just was like, what else can I do? I can run, I can jump, I guess. And I did maybe like jokingly, like a hot minute of track while I was in grade eight. So maybe I can do that. And if everyone knows all the track athletes around the world that did it at university, you know, your track teams are looking for people. So when I called the track coach, Carla Nichols, she was like, yeah, of course you can come try out. Like, I don't know who you are, but please join us. Like, we'd love bodies. And that was a huge turning point in my athletic career and my development as a professional too. So
it's interesting to me. We talked a little bit about before we started recording about, you know, when we are fortunate enough to have somebody with a quote unquote profile come on, I get to go in and dig into their background a little bit and hopefully have, you know, a little bit of better questions than just the rote stuff that you get asked all the time. But you keep a lot of this, like the really, you know, the gritty stuff out. And it's like, that's like to hear that stuff and you know, you're whatever, 15 or almost 20 years later. And I can see it. Like when you talk about it, it's like, oh, right. And then that, and like, that's the magic, man. That's the part, like for you to be sitting in Regina, you know, whatever, be 6 hours or if whatever away from Brandon, and you just got cut. You don't even know if you're in school, and you weren't, you know, you're just broken up. And like you say, you were down, but there was never, am I done here? You were like, I'm going to figure this out. And I think that's probably a testament to some of the places that you ended up, right?
I would agree. I tend to agree. Yeah. I don't like giving up. It's so impossible for me to imagine stopping. And I will say to you, to everyone listening, like, that's also kind of dangerous. And I've had to do some work on that. The desire to never, ever stop going forward. It can also be replacing, you know, some of the introspective work that I get to do now. Right. I didn't realize what I was up to in terms of trying to just find that success to prove it to who, right? What was I doing? Like who was I trying to impress all the time? Was it me? Was it my family? Was it, you know, and those are the kinds of things you get to explore as you look back a little more, but I just want to put that out there. Like, I love that I am that way, but it also like served me the other way too. It was also a bit of a detriment sometimes if I couldn't stop. So,
oh yeah. And I think that's, that's, the knife's edge that you have to ride when you're like that. And when you're young, it's hard to be aware of that. Mm-hmm. It's just looking back on it. It's just interesting for us to hear that all these things were going on. And you were just steadfast about it. And I think that's, like I said, that's a testament to some of the places that you ended up later on.
Well, thank you. Yeah. So to segue from that, ultimately I made the track team. I mean, everybody makes a track team. They'll let you do it. But she, Carla Nichols was like, well, I'm, you know, here I am in this meeting at the end after tryouts and thinking like, what event singular am I going to do? Cause I don't really know how to do any of this properly. Like I can run, but if you've ever tried to run with a track and field team, you have no idea how to run if you didn't do it before. And a lot of these athletes started track when they were like young, like 6, 7 years old. And at this point I'm like, you know, 20, 21 ish. And I'm like trying to redo this thinking I'm athletic. She says, yeah, we're going to make you a multi-eventer. What are you talking about? So indoors, I did the pentathlon, and outdoors, I did the heptathlon. So just like the men's decathlon is 10, the women's is 7 events. And that's hurdles, high, long shot, javelin, the 200 and the 800. And that meant that I had 7 events to learn, and I was about to do it in front of everyone. You know, Pan West was about to see it all. So I was served up a very large piece of humble pie as an athlete for the first 2 years, for sure. And it was a life-shaping experience. And spoiler alert, like, I obviously got into the school of journalism. So, and I was the only full-time athlete in that whole program to do everything at the same time. So it was a challenge, but it made me who I am for sure.
Well, and you mentioned that you kind of grew up in front of the whole world there, but you did eventually, or I don't know eventually if it's the right word, but you did have some success, right? You were at the end of all this, there's a happy ending here.
Yeah. There was actually quite a bit of success in terms of being able to find some medal positions, and whether it was like individual events or otherwise. And in the end, I would, you know, get a bronze medal at Can West and in indoor hurdles and things like that. Like, there was, it showed that there was some real potential, and it was seen in me. And I really appreciate her seeing that, because I spent a lot of time in the back of packs just being like, what am I doing? But it also, to the point of what happens after this, put me in contact in the same zones, training with some of the most incredible athletes in Canada and the coaching staff that came along that. And that is really what, you know, once I said, like I said at the beginning of the episode, like the hang, like who I got to spend time with was going to be more impactful long-term, and it continues to be the case, than what I was doing and what medals that now live in a box someplace inside my house. You know, like I am so proud of myself for those moments, and they were like so monumental, but it was about who I got to meet along the way and how, you know, you never know how those people are going to impact you, and vice versa, how I was going to impact them.
I think that's an incredible sentiment. Unfortunately, I think that's often something that you don't appreciate in real time, right? I think that, like, you know, everyone wants to know, why can't we know when it's the good old days? But that's a different thing.
It's now. Like, it's now, yeah, people.
Right.
It's happening.
Exactly. Like, you're meeting these people, and to your point, they may not help you exactly today, mm-hmm. but at some point, the fact that you came across these people and you lived that life and you had that journey, when you do the spur of the moment move to Calgary, you have these tools that these people gave you that allow you to have the confidence and the abilities to go and try something that is a, you know, is a road at one point almost to the Olympics, right?
Uh-huh. You know, spur of the moment or otherwise, the reality of that move was that it had to happen. It was another really big life-changing moment was going on. I was, again, in a relationship, and it was not going well, and I needed something different. So I say that just so that people understand, like, it wasn't like I woke up one day and thought, you know what, I want to go to Calgary. There was a kind of a long, slow burn of things not being very good. And while I was at that point running the 400 meter hurdles only for the last kind of couple of years of my career outdoors, I was done school, et cetera, et cetera. And I was working full time. I really needed to get out, and out meant kind of trying to find some other extended family that I could be with. And Calgary presented itself perfectly. A lot of those athletes and coaches who I worked with in the track and field world were out in Calgary. And I figured, you know what? I had never lived there. There wasn't a ton of family that, you know, would maybe make it too easy for me. I like a little bit of a challenge, but it also meant that there wasn't a lot of outside perspective that I could kind of just carve my own path. And I did, but, that's how, you know, people ask, like, how did you end up in Calgary? And then how did you end up doing skeleton? Well, both those things just collided. It wasn't very long after I moved here to Calgary that I'm still here, even though I've gone away and come back, that coaches reached out to me and said, like, we have some athletes that we'd love to have you train with. As it turns out, they do skeleton. You might've heard about it, but don't worry about that. You know, like, that's not what's important. I was totally being asked to come and try, but they didn't want to terrify me. And I was 25. So I think they were like, maybe she's like a bit old for this, but that was kind of how it all just kicked itself into high gear.
Just as you said that, something popped into my mind. How do you reconcile, as a young journalist, as a young lady, and then being kind of maybe considered too old for something at 25. Like at 25, nobody in any career is considering you, you know, even borderline competent at lots of careers. But in for athletes, 25 is like, they're, it's like, time
on your way out.
So how do you reconcile that when you kind of, when it dawned on you maybe that this is what's happening and that was the reservation versus your real life where you're not old at all?
Yeah, I think there was a little double-edged there, because in the sport still at that point, and who would become teammates with me were people like Melissa Hollingsworth, who was 25 or older, right? She'd been doing it for a bit. So there was that view where I was like, okay. Oh, well, there's still some, I'll say older, Melissa, you're not old, people that were in the sport at the time. And I could see that from my perspective. And a lot of the athletes that came in when I started learning as well were young, like 15, 16 years old. But they, I can also see from right away that they didn't have the athletic experience that I had. So reconciling it for me was creating a space of a timeline. I gave myself 5 years to make the national team. Now that might seem like a long time for people, but in 4 year intervals for an Olympic sport, it's not. And I knew that the first year was going to be just a lot of quite literal, like banging around and just like hitting everything. And it was, but also figuring out a sport that, you know, to the joke that you made before, was nothing like I'd been in. It was a very individual sport and I was going to have to do a lot of stuff on my own. But it also meant I needed to build a team around me. So I needed time. So I told the Alberta Skeleton Association at the time, I said, like, look, what's the real reality of this? Like, how many people I'm looking around? There's a lot of people that are still kicking around that have never made the national team. I'm going to give myself 5 years. And if by the time I'm 30, I haven't made the national team, like legitimately competing at the world class level, and I'm done, because I don't want to spend my whole life trying to chase something that, you know, I think a lot of people, and I could see it at the time, are going to say like, oh, it's just a niche sport. Like anyone could do that, because I could come in the door and tell you that a lot of people can't. Most people can't be good at that sport. I know it looks like you're just laying there, but it is super intense and super technical. And I desperately wanted to prove to myself that I could. So at the time, it didn't bother me as much. But then as I got older and older and was into my 30s and was hearing more and more about it, that's when it became really difficult, because it did affect me long term in terms of what happened at the end. I was technically too old for them to want to continue to push me along. And I had to fight against that. So I don't think at first, to answer your question, it was as much a problem. I just ignored it. Yeah. And then eventually it became fairly difficult to ignore, because I had success and then was fighting against it kind of in reverse.
Well, yeah, and just the physiology of it, like at 25, and you have this experience athletically that you spoke of. I mean, you have, even no matter how gifted a 17-year-old woman would be, she just physically, you're going to be advanced, whether you've had the experience that you had or not. Yeah. But then when that starts to move along, you know, you're fighting and working extra hard, and that person might be just naturally gaining that.
Yeah.
And now you're like, yeah, exactly. Right. And it's like, so you've just pumped yourself up to do it, to get it through the door. And now it's like, there's no end to the mental and physical anguish that's coming down the pike for somebody. And like you said, you only get that payoff once every 4 years. So it's maybe. Like, maybe, right?
Maybe. Yeah. There was a lot against me, you know, maybe the deck was stacked against, but that's how it is for anyone of any sport, regardless of whether everyone in the world watches it or not, to be so uniquely focused on something the way that an Olympic sport demands wasn't even something that I had fully understood yet. So I was about to get a real, real hard learning system I needed to do.
Yeah. You've never seen anybody at that level win and be like, actually not that bad, John. It was pretty easy. Yeah, just kind of showed up.
I just
got
here and it was like, this was fun. You, and I've said this before, but it's worth repeating, like, you have to break yourself into a million pieces to win an Olympic medal, and I have never won one, but I have been with, next to, like in the same room, on the same stage as those people. And it's never not been true. Like, I don't care what sport you do, it is 100% the case.
That's just so wild, because the perception from the outside is these physically gifted people
get identified early, and they just are given all these advantages to proceed to that goal. Mm-hmm. And it's just not the case. That's just what people like me tell ourselves. You know what I mean? It's just, it's no different. They're just people put their pants on one leg at a time that just had a break here or there, and then worked extra hard. Right.
So. Yeah. And honestly, the way that that different athletes will break, I mean, I'm not going to speak for everyone, but it's not always that physical. For some people, they are that physical prowess that just like walks in the door and can figure it out. Right. But there's no two ways about it. Like the mental side of sport, I'll say specifically to sliding sports, is so incredibly demanding. Both from a political and a proprioceptive side, like for you to play the game at a level like that I've been at, no one could prepare me for that. Like I had a lot going for me, but I didn't know what I was going to face. And thankfully I had enough wherewithal. And I think that's why I was glad that I was the age I was when I started, that I had some sense about it. And I could see the writing on the wall really fast in both directions, in both the really positive angles and the times that were more challenging. So it served me very well.
So at this point, you're pushing towards an opportunity at the Olympics, and you're training for that. The accolades are there. Canadian champion, World Cup medals, an Olympic alternate, too many podium finishes to mention. walk through like that whole experience, I guess, and kind of the highs, the lows, and you know, was there ever a time where you were like, okay, this was exactly why I did this, and what was the time when you were like, okay, this, I can't do this anymore?
Okay, I'll try to condense those thoughts. So the meteoric rise, as it's been related to in articles, of my career is just that I was competing on the basic circuit, America's Cup at the time, it's North America's Cup now, and was finding success, much in part to many of the other like retired and otherwise athletes that were willing to help me figure things out. And I was a quick study and got some great equipment and was able to really just like put things together, both on the ice for pushing and on my sled as a driver. But driving the sled ended up being the most natural thing for me, which seems super strange because I didn't do anything of the role. Like I didn't downhill mountain bike, I didn't do much skiing. So that whole like finding a line and connecting to your equipment wasn't something that I understood. Turns out I was pretty good at it. So that was kind of my angle. That's what made it so fast for me, because while I couldn't always push super fast, regardless of my track and field background, I'm not a super great sprinter, and everyone knew it. I knew it, my coaches knew it. I had to work extra hard, not only because I was 25 and declining athletically in some ways, but also because naturally pushing something bent over is unnatural. So my chain of muscles needed a lot more work, focus, ankles, et cetera. My point being that I was able to drive the sled really well, really fast. And once I had my equipment figured out, by the time I made the national team, I could barely be beat in terms of like inner Canadians. And that was where things started changing. It was a surprise to me in some cases, and in some ways it wasn't. But once I made the World Cup team and won, you know, nationals that year and did the selections in the way that I did, I knew I was where I was meant to be. Because within two races on World Cup, I was already sitting in a fourth place position or a third place, and ended up fourth, still a medal, et cetera, et cetera. But these moments where I had been watching all these women around me compete for a few years already, and now suddenly I'm standing next to them in the start house, I knew. And being able to figure out tracks on tour that first year that I'd never seen in my life. And for those of you that don't know, like typically a skeleton athlete, bobsleigh, luge, same thing. You have 3 days of official training. And in those 3 days, you get two runs a day. Most times those runs last 1 minute, which means you have 6 minutes to get your shit together, to figure out equipment, to figure out choices, to figure out what the weather's going to do and how the track's set up. The track stays the same every year, but it depends on the time of year that you come there. Most of the time, you might have notes in the past because you've been on tour for a number of years. In my case, number of the 9 tracks that we went to, I think like 6 of them, I had never seen. I had never been to, because I basically jumped from that North America's Cup all the way up to World Cup without doing a single tour in between. So when I figured those tracks out really quickly within 3 days and was able to compete for like top 10 spots, that's when I knew I was where I belonged, to answer that question. Now, the Olympic situation, I did not expect to be vying for a spot in 2014. That was not really on my radar. 2018 was kind of the goal, because I figured there's no way I'm going to just be competing with these people that have been here for that long. Well, I was wrong. And I realized real quick that I was wrong. And then suddenly the focus started turning to a potential Olympic spot. So going into the Olympic year, I was eighth in the world, and I'm like, oh, oh wow, this is real. So my personal focus and opinion of myself changed too. But that also came with a different level of pressure that I didn't expect. That expectation, the fear of not making it crept into my mind. All the people that were stepping up to support me financially, emotionally, mentally, were going to be let down. So it was no longer just me riding on my sled every day. It was the weight of all of that expectation. So I had to manage that. And for the most part, I did pretty well. But I was also really new in that world, and I did falter. There were moments where I definitely didn't do what I needed to be doing, and it showed on the time results. And that's really what they were pulling. To become an alternate was the worst experience, because up to that point, I was ranked high enough that I would have been, if they just picked based on ranking of the country, I would have been the second sled because of how things went. Some decisions were made politically, some athletes were moved around, and I was sent down a tier. So I went down to the Intercontinental Cup. I was told that at the time, if I could win these two races that were in Park City, so away from the World Cup team, away from support, all those other circuits at the time just had less support, it's just how it was, then there'd be an opportunity to vie for that third spot, because they decided to name two spots at the Christmas break. So now I was hunting down for this third spot. So against all the odds, and I tell this story because it's like pretty, this is one of the most like, I did everything I was asked moments where you're like, I did it. I can't believe it. It was a double race in Park City. The first day, some weird anomalies were happening. Technically, I crossed the line and like the clock didn't stop during the race. And I had never seen that happen. And I was panicking, but you know, thankfully they had a second, like a lot of things all worked out. And I would win that day. And I was like, okay, amazing. I won this race. Fantastic. Let's wake up the next morning. A snowstorm. Well, I already told you I'm only 5'7" and I didn't weigh very much when I did a skeleton. So snow was not my friend in the sport. And I remember like looking out the window and being like, holy shit, it's fine. We're going to figure this out. Put on the different set of like steel runners on you're going to find the line. And I won that race. It ended up becoming like a one heat race or something, right? So I did all the things, and in that moment, I was like, I did it. I did the thing I needed to do. Now I get to go back to Europe and I can go earn my spot. The rest of the team that was in Europe for the World Cup women's team was all suffering concussion symptoms. And because of that, I wasn't informed of that fully to the point that I could have made a decision to go over there and compete for my spot. But the night before the final race, when they would name the Olympic team, like the last race before the points came in for the 2014 games, and say like, here's the countries that have three sleds, because only so many countries get three sleds, they pulled all three girls out of the race. And I was told like the night before the race, so there was not even time for me to get there and like try and compete for my spot. That was it. So not only was there no decision made in terms of us getting, we've never not taken three people to the Olympics for the women up to that point. So the decision was a health decision, which I support 100%, but I was completely in good health. And had there been some conversation around that beforehand, I could have flown. I had sponsors who were ready to put me on a plane. Everybody was just like, go. And I said, no, it's fine. Like, I'll get my chance. Don't worry about it. Like, let's get the most points possible for Canada. And so I got brought into an office and just sat across from the high performance director at the time, and you won't be going. And this is that's it. Like, it's over.
Wow. That's an incredible story. I mean, we all understand the politics that go into everything at that level.
Yeah.
But the honesty, that you just shared with us is, I mean, I didn't know how that was going to end. There was as many twists and turns as a skeleton track in that story.
Yeah. And the like subsequent depression that followed that was monumental. Yeah. But I will say that I ignored it for as long as I could. I still trained for two more years, well, 2.5 more years after that, trying to go towards the next games, thinking that, you know, I could do whatever it took to recreate that situation, but this time on my terms.
And that's a question that I ask lots of times, kind of at this point in the interview, where we've kind of established where people started and where they're going through, is how did you deal with that stuff mentally? And a lot of times it's a person in their living room, in their kitchen, in their life. Yours, I mean, for the people that were willing to look at it, it was fairly public.
It was. And I think because there was a lot of, I couldn't get a lot of people to agree with that's the way the story went. That made it really hard. It made it difficult. There's always multiple sides to a story. And I agree, you know, I think we all experienced it from the coaching staff to the other athletes differently. And I respect and appreciate everyone's perspective. This is my story. This is how it went for me. This is the way I remember it. But to not be validated in a way where you're really in pain sucked. Mm-hmm. It sucked so bad because you were with people that you'd spent your entire time with for multiple years at that point. And there wasn't anyone coming to your door to say like, hey, are you okay? It was just radio silence. So that's when it really hurt the most, when you realize that, you know, bring it back again, that the hang didn't even matter. I was literally on an island like, oh, wow, this sport is by yourself. Like, you are alone. There were people that cared about me lots and they still existed and they were still there. But for me in that moment, that's how it felt. And it just shattered me. Like, I was just like, what is this shit? Why am I doing this? Like, what is this for? Because even if I went and won the Olympics, like, I'm getting a T4 first for the amount of money that the government of Canada is going to give you. So like, what, you know, what is going on? So I had a lot of questions and really just like tried to deal with them the best I could without a lot of tools. And it wouldn't really come into my view for a couple of years before I really could, you know, suss out someone that could help me. And it was performance coaches here locally in Calgary and other athletes and just finding my way through it. It wasn't like a program. There wasn't someone like, for people that didn't get to compete at the Olympics, like, please step here. Like, I can't believe it. It wasn't there. No, I had to figure it out. And at first I ignored it. And I really pushed it away because I was really upset for other people. Like, I was embarrassed. I was like sad. I was all the things. But I didn't want to give up. And that's kind of to what I said before, like, because I couldn't stop, because I wouldn't stop, I wouldn't deal with it. It was easier for me to just like, I'm going to keep going and distract myself long enough to just like, hopefully if I just push through it, then I won't feel that way anymore. And I'll find like what I love about this sport again. And I'll reconnect to that spot, that moment, that flow. And it came and went, but it was never the same. Like, it was just never there. Everything changed. The whole sporting scene for skeleton changed after that. And it wasn't just because of what happened to me. We lost a ton of money. All our coaching staff and everything just fell through the floor. So like, from being this identified high performance Olympic hopeful to being like, who are you again? Like, from the people that were giving money to us, right? You were like, wait, what's happening here?
Right.
So that was where it really, I had to turn all the focus on finding sponsors and doing things in a different way for myself, which then created a whole other world of animosity because I wanted to say no to things. And I was like, I'm not doing it that way anymore. We're doing it this way. But I learned a lot that way and still saw success in changing equipment and all the things that people say, like, don't do that. It's going to cause too many variables. And I got to finish in a way that I knew I was done. So to answer your question, finally, that you'd asked, like, when you knew it was finished, short answer is, again, I got pushed, oddly enough, to a Park City race. I got asked to do a race off against another athlete in a very, like, as far as I'm concerned, and I'll say it, a very arbitrary reason. It was completely unnecessary. I drove down myself with my dad. He's just always there for all these things. And we came down, like, ourselves on our own dime. There was no support for this. And we went down to do a race off, and it was chaos. It was, like, an absolute cold snap. It was, like, minus 40 Celsius, and the ice screwed up. I broke a visor. I had a bleeding nose in practice. I've never done that before. It was a horror scene. I took off my helmet. This is like the day before the race. The race happened, and my last race officially, like, I lost by a tenth. And we only did it. It ended up being like, oh, it doesn't matter. The point was, it was just everything was stacked against me. And I also wasn't in it. Like, I was trying to be, but I think I'd already said, like, this is like, enough's enough. Like, what am I trying to prove at this point? I've been there for 8 years already. Like, if I hadn't showcased that I was ready to be at that level anymore, and there was enough people that were saying, like, that's not who we want on the team, then there was nothing I could do. So as it ended that way, I remember driving home in a snowstorm back from Utah and getting home and just like turning off all my notifications, not answering any emails, just ignoring anything that was coming my way. And every day I woke up and asked myself, like, do I want to do this anymore? Do I want to be on this team? If I was to make the Olympics again, would I want to be there with this crew, like with this team, with this people that I'd hang with?
The hang.
And then the answer was no. And nothing against anyone. It was just, I was done. Like, I wasn't passionate about it anymore. My heart was broken and I needed to deal with it. And physically, I was okay, which I, you know, am very grateful for, because some people didn't have that experience. Their bodies and their brains and all these things have changed since they've been in skeleton, because it's a really intense sport, and not in the way of like smashing your head against the ground. It's these non-impact concussions, and physically, like, your backs get really messed up from doing the things that we do in that sport. So I'm really grateful that I was able to walk away and still be a really great athlete in my life now, and take on other things. But it was an emotional roller coaster, and one that I was finally ready to get off of.
Well, and because you had this journalism degree and you had these abilities outside of it. Yeah. So you weren't, you know, the 17-year-old who's never known anything and is washed up at 26. You were, You had these things. And with that experience, you've been able to parlay a lot of really cool journalism, you know, scratching both itches. You didn't have to walk away from it completely, right?
That's right. Yeah. So I banged on the CBC Olympics door for 5 straight years after that, just like, give me a chance. When you don't have an Olympic medal, you're not necessarily as much on the radar. And it was just about persistence for me. I really, really wanted to see if that sports broadcasting analyst position suited me as well as I felt like it was going to. You can all be the judge, go check out the last Winter Games. But I did get a chance to be in there and do a lot of the women's and men's races over the course of the winter, even just World Cup races. So if you, you know, tune in, guess what? It's also on during the year when it's not the Olympics. So I got to check a lot of those things out for the last 3 years. And then I actually got asked to do the Summer Games and got to go to Japan and be on the other side of the mic for the Summer Games as a mixed zone reporter. So there's those things. And I wrote for CBC and some other publications as well. And there's never not been a way for me to use those skill sets and really decide for myself if this is what I want to do. And yeah, so in that way, I've always been really lucky, I suppose. But more than that, I made that luck. Like, I knew I needed a career because I knew I was going to want to be good at something that was going to pay me in a different way. So journalism really, really served me and continues to serve me as I'm now working in like the tech scene. So and being able to still be a part of that sport world as the other side of the microphone, telling the stories and connecting the viewer with what is often a very confusing sport. Like, why would you do that? So yeah, it's a gift.
Well, from sitting here for the last 40 minutes chatting with you, from being a 5'7" left side power hitter to all the things, I don't hear a lot of spots in your story where the word luck is even a thing. Like, there's a dogged determination and an inability that we talked about earlier, sometimes even to your own detriment, to just let things happen the way they may. I'm, you know, a handful of times throughout this story, I've been like, okay, that's where I would have stopped. And you're like, deep breath. And it's like, man, this is incredible. Some of the things that you dealt with, you know, I until you actually sit down and chat with somebody, you don't know what all goes into these stories and these incredible lives that you've led to this point. I mean, you're still, by any stretch other than Olympic athlete measure, a very young woman, right?
Yes. Even as an Olympian potential, you know, you never know. But no, for sure. Like, I'm not quite 40 yet and still doing really athletic things. Like, right out of the gates after I retired from competition, I took up kickboxing because I think I finally was like, I gotta put this rage someplace. And I love it. But I'm so grateful for my body and everything that I've created in this section of time, like, because it has allowed me to do those types of things and to step into another world and connect with a bunch of other people in a completely different way, in a different scenario, and challenge myself physically and mentally, because getting punched in the head is nothing like doing skeleton, I can tell you, in a way that really helps me create the next chapter. And again, it's always about the people, because that's what did it. I had to connect with an amazing coach and Philip Nduga to find kickboxing to be like, okay. Yeah. I think I could do this. I had never, ever done anything on my own. And I say that with love, because I couldn't have, like, to your point, I would have stopped 100 times. I would have been like, this is bullshit. I don't want to do this anymore. It's hard. I'm tired. I'm sad. I'm broke. And my body is in a million pieces. I don't want to do this anymore. But there would always be some voice somewhere, whether it was my own in my head or someone else's sounds like mine, it would be like, no, you're not done yet. You're not done yet. You haven't seen it through. And until I could tell myself that, I just wouldn't stop.
So at the end of every podcast, I like to talk or ask the guest what their vision of success or what their definition of success is at this point in their life. How different is it from earlier in their life? And did they ever expect it to look like this?
Well, I'll start at the end. I had no expectations that this would be where I would land. And I'm grateful that I did. But I think my vision of success has always been very similar. To some extent or another, it has always been about being able to change perception for someone else. And I mean that to say of themselves. I have never looked at my life and gone, oh, well, there's no way you could do that. Or there's no way you'd be able to figure that out. And if by going through all of these different journeys and experiencing them the way that I have, has only shown one person the opportunity in themselves to say, oh yeah, maybe I'll try that, and then did it, then I'm that's success for me, because I would never be who I am today without all of that. I actually have no idea who I'd be. Maybe completely different, very likely. But I'm so fiercely proud of who I am and who I get to stand here in front of you and say that I am, because I wouldn't say like, nah, not me. Like, yeah, possibly. Let's find out. And as much as it feels shitty to be bad at stuff, everyone listening, it feels way cooler when you start figuring it out. And then sometimes you really, really figure it out and you could possibly be the best ever at it, but you don't know unless you take that first step.
Really fun pod with somebody who's got an interesting story and really has the kind of the details down. Like she said, she's told it a bunch of times and she's really kind of got the parts that, you know, were the turning points or the cornerstones of her story. She's got them down and she talks about some of the politics that went into it and some of the things like the, you know, with her dad being sick and all the different things that go into the life of somebody who's performing at that level. It's really incredible to hear somebody kind of look back on it. And while it's still fresh and they're not really all that done with it, and recount how they managed to do some of those incredible things with their life. You got to remember, she was so young when she was making a lot of these decisions to move all around the country. You know, Brandon, Manitoba is kind of right in the middle of Canada, and she was on both sides of it. And she got to do so many amazing things that people just don't get an opportunity to do. And here she is now, still a very young woman, and she's able to sit back and share these stories with us. And it's great to understand what goes into that life so that when we're sitting around going, man, my cup just isn't full, I need to figure something else out, we can listen to these stories and understand the pratfalls and things that, you know, may take a little longer than we thought. And then finding out that if you keep going at it, it doesn't mean it can't come. It's just taking a little time. That's your path, right? Just like that was Cassie's. So another great podcast. Super happy to have Cassie on. She couldn't have been more gracious with her time. And we just are having a lot of fun with this. This is so much fun to sit down and chat with these people and get to hear these stories. Natasha, Tyler, a few of the more recent ones have been so good. People have been responding. The numbers have come back out of the summer so strong. We kind of have a renewed vigor to keep doing this and start finding some really, you know, cool new people to bring their stories to you. So we always like to end this with telling everyone there are no wrong answers and no test at the end. So make the most out of every day.
The Second Act podcast would like to thank Ben Sound for the intro and outro music, Happy Rock. That is www.bensound.com. We'd also like to thank Chin Whiskers for the promotional consideration. You can find them at your local Tommy Guns, Original Barbershop, Amazon, or chinwhiskers.ca. And we would also like to thank you for listening.
Test the microphone. No noise.